The title of the message this morning is Identity, the Choice is Clear. You know, I realize this morning as I look out amongst you that I'm speaking to a very diversified group of people. You know, for some of you, this is going to be, I know, a very basic message. It's probably not going to be anything that you've heard before. But like the Apostle Peter, I don't mind stirring up your minds by way of reminder. And for this reason, because I know far too often there's the need today for the same admonition that we find in Hebrews 5:12, where it says, "For by this time you ought to be teachers, and you have need again for someone to remind you of the elementary principles of the oracles of God." So for some of you this may be a very basic message, but I want to remind you of the foundation that we stand on, or at least part of the foundation that we stand on as Israelites. And sometimes, for you again who have understood or been in identity, some of you much longer than I have, sometimes we just need to be reminded of where we came from. I know I've been in identity for just a very short amount of time, but I'm already forgetting where I was when Pete first started reaching out to me with this message. I forget how I reacted, and thus I forget how those other people are going to react, and sometimes I think we expect too much from the people that we reach out with this message to. And so if for no other reason, let this be a reminder of where we used to be and what we needed to know and what we needed to hear in order to understand what we understand today. And then for the rest of you, I know there's a few of you because I've talked to some of you. For the rest of you, this may be your very first real introduction to the identity message. You know, ever since the early pioneers of true Christianity in America were bold enough to stand on the Word of God and declare, "Where the Scriptures speak, we speak, and where the Scriptures are silent, we are silent," there have been those chosen few who would dare to do the same. People who have and are striving to keep themselves pure and uncorrupted by the religious standards of the day. People like you and me who want God's way or no way. And I believe that I can say that about you this morning. I believe that I can say that you're that type of people who want God's way or no way. I believe that you've demonstrated it throughout this week. And I believe if that wasn't the case, you wouldn't be here this morning. But you know, far too often, we put on our pious robes and we think to ourselves, "Oh, we've arrived, and no one else has truth." And thus we slam the door to further revelation from God. But thanks be to God for 1 Corinthians 8 and verses 1 and 2 that's there to remind us that knowledge makes arrogance, or that knowledge makes arrogant, and if anyone supposes that he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know. Now, I believe this morning that you have a responsibility. And I believe that responsibility in regards to something new, for those of you where this message might be new for you, you know, oftentimes when we hear a message, when we hear something new, oftentimes it makes us fearful. And I know this particular message did that for me. When Pete first started sharing the ideas that we might be Israel and that God still had a plan for Israel today, I feared that it was true. I was afraid of what it would do to my life, and it was shaking the very foundations that I was standing upon, or at least the foundations I thought were foundations that I was standing upon. And I feared it. And I think that is so often the truth for most people. When they hear something new, they fear it, and oftentimes they run. But I believe that you have a responsibility today, and that is that responsibility is to at least examine with an open and honest heart what I'm going to be sharing with you. We need to be like the Bereans in Acts 17:11, don't we? Where it says, "And these were more noble-minded than those who were in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the Scriptures daily to see whether these things are so." So I admonish you this morning, if you haven't heard this message before, or if you've just begun to understand it and hear it, that you be like the Bereans. I believe that I also have a responsibility in that same regard, and that is because I believe this truth that I'm going to be sharing with you is true indeed, I have a responsibility to share it with you. By the way, those of you who have come to the place in your lives where you already understand this, I believe that you have this same responsibility. I want you to know that I not only believe that what I'm going to share with you is true, but I believe its importance is nearly as important as salvation itself. And notice I said nearly. I don't believe it's equal in importance, but I believe it's right up there near. It's the importance of our salvation, our own personal salvation in our Lord. So what's this thing, identity, all about? You know, I'm going to do something that's homiletically incorrect. And if there's any of you homiletical preachers out there and you don't like it, you just have to cut it. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the last part of the message and I'm going to bring it up front. And I think you'll understand why, at least some of you who have been in identity for some time, because many of you have been out there sharing the identity message with friends of yours and people in your family, and you go through and you explain to them that God has a plan for Israel today. And then you prove to them that Israel today, the people, the group of people or the nation that God intends to work with, are the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred people. And you pour your hearts out to them, and how do they respond? What's the matter? What difference does it make? Now, I don't want to get done with this message and have some of you come up to me afterwards and say, what difference does it make? So I'm going to take the last part of the message, if you don't mind, and I'm going to put it up front, and I'm going to take care of that problem before it ever occurs. What difference does it make? I want to share with you some reasons why I believe this truth, if indeed it be truth, is vitally important. And you might want to write these down, because I think there are things that we can use to share with those who are going to be asking that question after you share the identity message with them. Number one, without this truth, the New Testament cannot be fully interpreted correctly. Without this truth, the New Testament cannot be fully interpreted correctly. As basic as having a correct understanding of whom many of the New Testament books are written to. And that's the first law of hermeneutics, the study of the Scriptures. You've got to know, or the second law, you've got to know who the writer is writing to. The very essential truth. There were books in the New Testament that I had misunderstood who it was that the writer was writing to until I understood identity. There's many doctrines that I believe cannot be understood until you understand identity. I avoided, for example, Romans 8 through Romans 11 because it was just a haze to me over the last 10 or 12 years of my Christian walk. Anybody wanted to talk about Hebrews 8 or 11 except for a few key passages? I just avoided it because of the predestination language of that. But when I understood identity, within weeks, that whole passage was cleared up completely. Talking to Brother Watson is possibly helped to even clear that up a little bit more. But the identity message helped me to understand that passage. And again, unless we understand this message, if indeed it is true, we will never interpret the New Testament fully correctly. Number two, without this truth, most Old Testament prophecies cannot be interpreted accurately. Without this truth, most Old Testament prophecies cannot be interpreted accurately. For example, in Ezekiel 38, we have most of Christians today thinking that Gog and Magog, Russia, is going to invade the land of Palestine. Well, unless you understand who Israel indeed is today, you'll never understand that it's going to be the very shores of America, our homeland, that Gog and Magog will invade someday, or really already has. And number three, without this truth, our fight against sin, whether it be homosexuality, abortion, pornography, illicit sex, etc., 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 is nearly in vain. Without this truth, our fight against sin is nearly in vain. I might say that a whole message could be devoted to this. Regretfully, we don't have the time to do this. So I hope that you will research each one of these out on your own. Number four, without this truth, and this is possibly the most important one of all, without this truth, fewer people will be led to Yahshua the Messiah. By the way, I'm going to be using Yahshua instead of Jesus at this point in time because I believe it's the more correct pronunciation of our Savior's name. But I ask you not to stumble over that. If you don't have that understanding, I'm not using it to condemn you in any way. Just understand that when I use Yahshua the Messiah, I'm talking about your Jesus. Without this truth, fewer people will be led to our Messiah, Yahshua the Christ. Not only from our own people, but from the other nations as well. And then number five, Without this truth, our future depends on this truth. Hosea 4:6 says, "My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge, for a lack of understanding." Yahshua himself said in John 8:32 a very similar idea when he said, "Truth shall make you free." And you know, if this indeed is truth, we are really denying the Messiah himself. Because Yahshua himself said in John 14:6, he said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And people, when we deny truth, once we see or understand that it is indeed truth, and we deny it, we have denied the very Messiah himself. So, if this be truth, there is freedom and great importance in knowing it. I believe that there's three important points that we need to cover this morning that I believe are very important in sharing this message with people who have never heard it before. Number one, I believe that we need to ask the question, or we need to deal with the question, is God still working with Israel today? And sometimes I think we get the cart as identity folk. I think sometimes we get the cart before the horse. And we get so excited about sharing with the rest of the world that we are Israel that we forget to prove to them first that God is working with Israel today. So you perceive there's a lot of people today who believe it doesn't matter simply because they believe that God is no longer working with Israel. So even if we are Israel, it really doesn't matter. And so oftentimes we get the cart before the horse, and there are people out there that we need to first show them from the New Testament that God is still working with Israel today, physical Israel. Number two, if we find that indeed he is then working with Israel, then who are the true Israelites today? So first of all, we need to find out if God is still working with Israel, and secondly, if indeed we find that he is, we need to find out who Israel today is. And then if time permits, we want to deal with the reactions that we often get to this message. So let's begin. Is God still working with Israel in the New Testament today or during the New Covenant times? You know, God's plan for the Israelites in the Old Testament is obvious to anyone who will take the time to read it. And I believe that few, if any, question that God chose Israel under the Old Covenant for a special task. Deuteronomy 14:2, for example, is one of a multitude of Old Testament passages that makes this clear, where it says, "For you are a holy people," speaking of Israel, "to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of this earth." Earlier in Genesis 28:14, a similar promise was made to Jacob, who was later called Israel. And it says, "Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in you and all your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed." But the question we have to look at today, I don't think anyone questions that the fact that God dealt with Israel under the Old Covenant or under the Old Testament, or in the Old Testament times, in a very special manner, that he called them out, that he called them to a special task. But the question we have to ask today is, but what about a plan for Israel in the New Testament era? Does God still have a plan for the descendants of Abraham, Jacob, and Isaac? Or Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Or did his plan for the Israelites simply end when the Old Covenant ended and the New Covenant began? You know, I believe that not only will further study of the Old Testament reveal the true answer to those questions, but also a closer look at the New Testament will reveal to the one who studies to show himself approved the plan that God has for his people Israel. So let's take a look at the New Testament. And let's do that by asking a question, and I think probably one of the most important questions that could ever be asked in relation to the New Covenant era. And that is, who was the New Covenant made with? And I'll have to say that is the question that really began my understanding of the identity message. Because Pete brought that very question to me at the very beginning some 5 or 6 years ago. And he asked me, and I probably need to say this first of all, that I was one who prided myself in giving scriptural answers for what I believed. I believed in speaking where the Scriptures speak and being silent where the Scriptures are silent. And Pete asked me, "Well, Ted, who was the new covenant made with?" Well, I have to admit to you that I gave him the wrong answer. And I certainly didn't have a Scripture to back up the answer I gave him. And I think if you're out there hearing this message for the first time, I think that probably, as I ask that question to you, who was the new covenant made with, that if you're typical, like 90% of the rest of the people in the religious world today, you're going to give one of two answers. Either I don't know, or you're going to give the wrong answer. So let's look and see what the Bible says, what the Bible teaches us in answer to this question, who was the new covenant made with? Most of you are probably already there. In Hebrews, we need to go to Hebrews, the 8th chapter. Hebrews chapter 8, and we'll begin with verse 7. Hebrews 8 and verse 7. "For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion sought for a second. For finding fault with them, he says, 'Behold, days are coming, says Yahweh, when I will effect a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant which I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and I did not care for them, says Yahweh. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says Yahweh, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them upon their hearts. And I will be a God, and they shall be my people, and they shall not teach every one his fellow citizen, and every one his brother, saying, Know Yahweh. For all shall know me, from the least to the greatest of them, for I will be merciful to their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more." You could probably, some of you are probably reading this passage or are going through it as I read it, and you're probably asking yourself, how in the world, after reading Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 8 specifically, how in the world could anyone deny or not see that God is working with Israel today? Well, see, it's very simple. Because don't you understand that God is working with spiritual Israel today? The church is who God is working with today. The ones who have accepted Jesus Christ in their heart, which is very interesting that isn't even found in the Bible. But nonetheless, it's those who have responded with Christ. Those are the ones from all nations who are Israel today. I have to admit, that's exactly what I was wanting to do with that passage. I'll bet if I had you raise your hand, there would be a lot of you who had done the same thing with that passage as well. And we need to remember that. We need to know where these people are coming from. But is that the case? Can it be proven that God is working with spiritual Israel today? That is who He is working with, or that is who He made this new covenant with? Well, let's let the Bible again determine the answer to those questions. Let's look at this passage in a little bit more detail and see what it really says and see whether it identifies a spiritual group of people or a physical group of people. Let's go back to Hebrews 8 and let's go through it just a little bit again. Hebrews 8, starting with verse 8, it says, "For finding fault with them, he says, 'Behold, days are coming, says Yahweh, when I will effect a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah.'" You might want to stop right there, and we probably need to ask the next logical question, and that is, well, who is the house of Israel and who is the house of Judah? And if you're like 90% of the people out in the religious world, you're probably going to come up with two answers. One, I don't know, or the wrong answer. That is if I was speaking to what we find in the majority of Christendom today. He'd asked me that question too, and I came up with the wrong answer. Well, I think that time I said, I don't know. He'd already got me in the corner, so I thought I'd better just back out as easily as I could. But who is the house of Israel and who is the house of Judah? Is it justified for us to take those two terms and spiritualize them? Well, were those two terms ever spiritualized in the Bible? No, they weren't. And they designate, as we know, the house of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, and the house of Judah, the 2 southern tribes. Many people, I think, too, want to make them one and the same. Oh, they're just one and the same. That's just Israel. You know, in the Old Testament, Israel and Judah were described as sisters. And sisters may be of the same family, but they can't be the same person. And I think we've got to, it's an important point that we have got to understand, or the people that we share with have got to understand the difference between the house of Israel and the house of Judah, as we'll see a little bit later on as we continue. Going on, let's see if there isn't other identifying marks or other things that would identify and help us to answer this question correctly, whether this is spiritual or physical Israel. First of all, the house of Israel and the house of Judah were only used in the Bible and every other place for a physical group of people, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Going on, he says in verse 9, he says, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers. Some say, oh, that's just talking about spiritual fathers. Well, let's continue. On the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, for they did not continue in my covenant. Now, the passage itself explains very clearly, or shows very clearly, that the house of Israel and the house of Judah in this particular passage has to be physical, because these were the descendants of those men who were led by Moses, those men and women who were led by Moses out of the land of Egypt. But you know, we can make it even clearer. This passage, as I'm sure some of you are fully aware, comes from the prophecy that was made in Jeremiah 31. And if we'll go to Jeremiah 31, we'll find it even much more clearer, or we'll be shown much more clearer that this has to be physical. Turn with me, if you would, to Jeremiah 31, and starting with verse 31. Verses 31 and 34 is what we find written again in Hebrews 8. Verse 8 and on. But if we will read just a little bit beyond what we find there in Hebrews 8, if we'll read just a little bit beyond verse 34, that which was quoted in Hebrews 8, we'll find more evidence that this has to be speaking of physical Israel. Look at verse 35, which would pick up right after what is written in Hebrews 8. And it says, thus says Yahweh, who gives the sun by light by day, and the fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar. Yahweh of hosts is his name. Verse 36, if this fixed order departs from before me, declares Yahweh, then the offspring of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. Now let me ask you, is the sun still shining today for light, and the moon for darkness? Well, if that be the case, then we have to admit that God is still working with Israel today. Going on, verse 37, thus says Yahweh, if the heavens can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out below, then I will cast off the offspring of Israel for all that they have done, declares Yahweh. Has anybody yet measured the heavens? We certainly maybe tried, but it certainly hasn't been accomplished yet. Or has anybody ever searched out the depths below? It's not been done, and people, it never will be done, because God's plan is to work with Israel throughout the ages. This very people, or this very nation that God has made his new covenant with. But you know, if we find that in Hebrews 8, or if we find something like, we find something written in the Bible, you usually expect to find it backed up in other places, don't you? So let's see if we can't do that. I'd like you to turn with me to Romans chapter 9. Anybody know, Bud, you know what time I'm supposed to finish? I'm afraid to ask. About 11:25, thank you. You say, 12:25, right? 11:25. Turn with me to Romans chapter 9. You know, Pete has shared with me Hebrews 8, and after he'd basically gone through what I have gone through with you, within moments, I had no argument that God did have a plan for Israel today, and it certainly wasn't spiritual Israel. But that is when I came up with the response, so what difference does it make? But I added this to it. What difference does it make? The Bible is full of dealings, or the New Testament is full of dealings with the Gentiles. And I think Pete attempted to explain the understanding of the Gentiles at that time, but it did not click. And it wasn't until some time later that Romans 9 all of a sudden jumped out at me. Romans chapter 9, and I want to start with verse 23 through 26. And I believe in this passage, we find the very same thing reiterated that we just went over in Hebrews 8. Romans chapter 9, and I want to be reading verses 23 through 26. And it says, "He did so in order that he might make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory, even us whom he also called, not from among Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles. As he says also in Hosea, I will call those who are not my people, my people, and those who are not beloved, beloved. And it shall be that in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they shall be called the sons of God." I had read that passage I don't know how many times, and never understood the correct meaning of it. And I believe because we have in Christendom today the wrong definitions for two words in that particular passage. And if we don't understand our definitions correctly, we'll never be able to understand the passage that those words are in or lie in. Again, in Romans 9 and verse 24 specifically, it says, "Even us, whom he also called, not from among Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles." I believe the two words that we need to understand and we need to be able to explain to those that we're sharing with is the two words Jews and Gentiles. Because to most people, and to me in the past, Jews simply meant all Israel, and Gentiles meant all non-Israel, as they were contrasted to each other. You know, I was, again, 4 or 5 years ago, I don't remember exactly how far it had been. I'd been studying identity for about 4 years. I'd been studying it, actually, to try to disprove it because of my fear that it was probably true. But I was studying. I was having a quiet time one morning out on my deck, and I just happened to be at the place of reading Hosea in the Old Testament. And I read the first two chapters, and as Pete mentioned earlier, it was like scales fell from my eyes. I couldn't believe that I'd been so blind because it was so very clear. And it is very clear if we'll let the Bible be its own commentary. But see, most people don't do that. The Bible even here tells us exactly where to go to understand this passage. And yet, because we already have it all figured out, or we have in the past, or the people in the religious world today, in their minds, have it all figured out. And remember, knowledge produces arrogance. The boasting of knowledge produces arrogance. But since they have it all figured out, they have no reason to go back to Hosea and read it, because the Jews to them, again, they've got it figured out, are all Israel. And thus the Gentiles, there is no choice but that the Gentiles have to be all non-Israel. The people, if we'll let the Bible be its own best commentary. And that's the only way we should go about studying the Bible, is to let it be its own best commentary. We can find the truth of what it's really saying. First of all, we have a misunderstanding about the word Jew. And again, we have made it to be synonymous with all Israel, when indeed it is not in the Bible at all. Many of you have heard this illustration, I'm sure, from other speakers, but that's the same as calling Americans Californians and Californians Americans. But that just won't work. Matter of fact, there's a lot of Californians that probably aren't even Americans today. We cannot make those two terms synonymous. Some Californians may be Americans, but not all Americans are Californians. And it's the same with the term Jew or Judean. The term Judean, as we use it or find it used in the Bible, is referring to only part of Israel. All Israel is not Judah, but Judah is Israel, at least as we find it used in the New Testament passages. Too many people today are making, as many of you again know, too many people today are calling Abraham, Moses, Jacob, and David Jews, when indeed they're not, because of this misunderstanding of who indeed the Jews today are. Not the Jews today, but the Jews as we find them written about in the Bible. But you know, if we'll go back to the Bible again and let the Bible explain itself, we will find that that term Jews or Judean is used for only one group of people and one group of people only. Now, Israel is divided, as we know, into 12 or 13 tribes. Let's limit it to 12 for the sake of this discussion. Israel is up here consisting of the 12 tribes, but at one point the 12 tribes were divided into two different houses, the house of Judah and the house of Israel. We need to understand that the house of Judah and only the house of Judah were known as Jews, but not only as Jews, but also obviously as Israelites, because they were a part of this 12-tribe Israel nation. They were called Israelites, but they were also called Jews, because under this side, they had become a divided nation known as the House of Judah. And thus, they were known as Judeans, or Jews as we often have it written in our Bibles today. And then over here we have the 10 northern tribes known as the House of Israel. We need to understand, and again we need to get it across to the people who we're sharing with, that this group of people, known as the House of Israel, were known as Israelites as well, but never as Jews. And sometimes, and I think this is important as well, sometimes not even as Israelites, because of them being divorced by God and dispersed amongst the nations or Gentiles. I don't have time to go into that in great detail, but I challenge you, if you don't already understand that, to go back to your Bibles and find if there's ever a place in the Old or New Testament where any people other than the house of Judah or the descendants of the house of Judah are called Jews. I'll guarantee it'll never happen. You'll not find it in the New Testament. You'll not find it in Ezra and Nehemiah or any other place. And thus it is false for us to call David or Moses or any of these other men who existed before this dividing of the kingdom to ever call them Jews. I challenge you first with that to understand, to come to the understanding of who truly the Jews are. Because if you don't come to the understanding of who the Jews are, you will never understand the true understanding definition of who the Gentiles are. So what about the Gentiles? Gentiles comes, as again many of you know, comes from the Greek word ethnos. But we have taken it, at least most of Christendom, has taken it to mean exclusively all non-Israelite people. But we find, as we look into the Bible, we will find, and specifically the New Testament, we will find a much wider use than as its limited use by most of Christendom. It's interesting, too, that most of Christendom uses Strong's exhaustive concordance and uses Vine's exhaustive dictionary to the New Testament words as study sources. And yet they have, again, made Gentiles exclusively all non-Israel. But even, it's interesting, if we'll go to Strong's and to Vine's even most specifically, we'll find that even Strong's and Vine's gives it a much wider sense than most of Christendom and most of the preachers today are giving it. Strong's, for example, says this: a race, as of the same habit, that is a tribe, specifically a foreign, non-Jewish one, usually by implication pagan. And then listen to some of the words of how it's translated: Gentile, heathen, nation, and people. Vine's is even more specific or more clear. It says it denotes firstly a multitude or company, then a multitude of the same nature or genus, a nation, people. It is used, and listen to this, it is used in the singular of Jews. Now, wait a minute, that can't be. Because Gentiles exclusively, with our past understanding or the understanding of those in the religious world today, Gentiles only exclusively means all non-Israelite people. And yet Vines says that in the singular it's even used for the Jews. Occasionally it is used of Gentile converts in distinction of Jews. You might want to write these down because we're not going to take the time to look at them. But I want to share with you the biblical usage of the term Gentile as we find it in the Bible, not just by its definition or its Greek definition, but instead looking at the scriptures themselves, the passages that use these words. And I want to give you four different usages as we find it used, this word ethnos, as we find it used in the New Testament. Number one, it's used as heathen or pagan. The passage that you can look to for this is 1 Peter chapter 4 and verses 3 through 4. It is also used as a multitude of people. Acts 17:26, and specifically there, the human race as a whole. And as Vines brought out, it's used of the Jewish people in the singular. Specifically, as we talk of the Jewish people, we're talking about the two southern tribes, the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. And there we find that one of the times that it's used that way is in Luke 23, verses 1 and 2. And then we find one more usage for this word ethnos, and it's in this passage, Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9, verses 24 through 25, with Hosea 1 and 2. And again, if we will let the Bible be its own commentary. And we'll do what this particular passage tells us to do. We'll go back to Hosea, and we'll find the true meaning for this particular passage, what it means when it talks about Gentiles or the ethnos. If you would, turn with me to Hosea chapter 1. I don't have the time, but I need to take the time at this point in time to pretty much read the whole first chapter of Hosea. So if you'd read with me. And specifically for you, again, where this might be the first time or one of the first times that you've heard this message. And I say it specifically in regards to this passage because this was my biggest stumbling block in understanding the identity truth. If we can understand again who the Jews are and who the Gentiles are specifically in this passage in Romans 9, I think that we'll overcome much that stops us from understanding this truth of the identity message. Listen to Hosea. Listen to who Hosea says are these people. And notice, keep your finger in Hosea. Let's go back to Romans chapter 9. And we need to look again at what it says here in Romans 9. Again with verse 24. It says, "Even us, whom he also called, not from among Jews." Who is that? We've hopefully been able to determine that we're there speaking of the house of Judah. "Even us whom he also called, not from among the Jews or the house of Judah only, but also from among the Gentiles." And then he says in Hosea, "I will call those who were not my people, my people, and her who was not beloved, beloved. And it shall be that in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they shall be called sons of the living God." And you can see why people would stumble over that passage or come to the wrong conclusion. Because if they don't go back to Hosea and they have this understanding that the Jews are simply Israel and the Gentiles are all non-Israel, it makes sense. Because all the Gentiles are the non-Israelite people, to them, we're never his people. But they fail to do what the Bible tells them to do here in regards to what is quoted here from Hosea. They forgot to go back to Hosea and let Hosea describe who is being talked about. And I want to challenge you and ask you to see if anyone in this audience can find non-Israelite people spoken of in this passage that was quoted there in Romans chapter 9. Starting with verse 1 of chapter 1 in Hosea, it says, "The word of Yahweh which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. When Yahweh first spoke through Hosea, Yahweh said to Hosea, 'Go take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry. For the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking Yahweh.' So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And Yahweh said to him, 'Name him Jezreel, for yet a little while and I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel.'" And start to pay close attention to what's going to be said following. "And I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel." Notice the distinction here too between the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Verse 5, "And it will come about on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." And she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. "And the Lord said to him, 'Name him Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I should ever forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by Yahweh their God, and will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen.' When she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, 'Name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it will come about that in that place where it is said to them, you are not my people.'" And I might ask you here to think, to ask yourself, who is he talking about at this point? Is there any evidence here that he's talking about non-Israelite people when he says, "You are not my people"? And it goes on, the time will come when he says, "You are not my people," it will be, or where it is said to them, "You are not my people," it will be said to them, "You are the sons of the living God." Something is going to change about this particular group of people. And again, who is this group of people? "And the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together, and they will point for themselves one leader, and they will go up from the land." You know, I challenge anyone in this audience or anyone in the whole Christendom, all of Christendom, to find anywhere in Hosea 1 and 2 where, again, Romans 9 is quoting from when it talks about these Gentiles who are no longer God's people or who aren't God's people who are, again, going to become God's people. I challenge you to find non-Israelite people in these two passages. And if you can't do it, then you cannot make the Gentiles spoken of in Romans 9 non-Israelite people, because that is not who Hosea is talking about. But if we understand the division between the house of Judah and the house of Israel, it becomes very clear that as we go back to Romans chapter 9, that Romans chapter 9 is saying the exact same thing that we found said in Hebrews 8 and verse 8, where it says again, and this is the covenant, I will effect a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Let's go back now with the correct definitions and understandings of these two words, Jew and Gentile, and let's see if it doesn't say the very same thing that we found there in Hebrews 8. Romans chapter 9 and verse 24. With the correct understanding, I think this passage can be translated in light of what we found in Hosea and the rest of the Bible. We find it saying, even us, whom he also called or made a new covenant with, not from among Jews or the house of Judah only, but also from among Gentiles or the house of Israel. And here we find a special use for the term Gentile, at least a special use for those who haven't understood its use before, because I believe that this is its primary use as it's used throughout the New Testament. That the Gentiles is designating primarily in the New Testament those people known as the house of Israel who were at one point divorced by God and dispersed amongst the Gentiles and thus became a Gentile people before the Lord, but a people who were going to be called back. And thus, there is, as we look at the New Testament, again, there is no question that God is still working and has a special plan for His people, Israel. I'm going to do this as quickly as I can. I decided, having come from a background that wanted to spiritualize Israel in the New Testament, I decided to do a compilation of New Testament scriptures that show very clearly that God is dealing with Israel. We've looked at Hebrews 8. We've looked at Romans 9. Are there other passages in the New Testament that show that God is dealing with the Hebrew people today, known as Israelites? Well, it's unbelievable. I couldn't believe when I did this. I made a compilation of all the scriptures in the New Testament that deal with Israel. And I want to just go through some of them. This is going to be in the back, and regretfully, I don't have enough copies for everyone here. Please take one per family. There'll be a couple other things there as well. If I run out, and I'm sure I will if you take some, if I run out, there's a sheet to put your name and address down, and I'll be glad to send any of you who don't get one. This will be back there, a compilation called Israel in the New Testament. And all it is just the New Testament passages that you can hand to someone and say, here, can you deny after you've read this that God has a plan for physical Israel today? Listen to some more of these passages, and again, I won't do them all. Matthew 1 and verse 21, it says, and she will bear a son, and he shall call his name Yahshua, for it is he who will save his people from their sins. Matthew 2:6 makes it even more clear, and he says, and you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, but are by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel. Luke 1 and verse 16, it says, and he, speaking of John the Baptist, will turn back many of the sons of Israel to the Lord their God. Luke 1 and verse 68, it says, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited us and accomplished redemption for his people. Luke 24 and verse 21, it says, but we, and this is speaking of the two with Yahshua on the road to Emmaus, were hoping that it was he who was coming to redeem Israel. John 1 and verse 31, it says, in order that he might be manifested to Israel, I, John the Baptist, came baptizing in water. But you could stop me right there and say, or I might stop right there, and you say, well, so what? That's all old covenant. The new covenant hadn't come into existence yet. Christ hadn't died on the cross yet and resurrected from the grave. That's old covenant. God is dealing with Israel. God did deal with Israel in the old covenant. That doesn't prove anything. Let's continue. Acts in verse 1:6, new covenant time. The other was they claim would be old covenant. Let's look at the new covenant. Acts in chapter 1 and verse 6, they, the 11 apostles, were asking him, saying, Lord, is it at this time you are restoring the kingdom to Israel? Romans verses 9, 4 through 5, listen to what this says. Who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption as sons, and the glory and the covenant? We know the Abrahamic covenant belonged to the Israelites, and the Mosaic covenant belonged to the Israelites. And now as a result of looking at Hebrews 8 and Jeremiah 31, we see too that the Christian covenant as well belonged to the Israelites. Who are Israelites who the covenants belong to, and the giving of the law and the temple services and the promises? Who are the fathers, and from whom is the Christ according to the flesh? I'm skipping many of these, but I want to kind of highlight a few of them. Hebrews 2 and verse 16, where it says, "For assuredly he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the seed of Abraham." James 1 and verse 1, where it says, "James, the bondservant of God and of the Lord Yahshua the Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad," or a better translation actually of that is those 12 tribes of or in the dispersion. 1 Peter 1:1 is a very similar passage. In Revelation 21, in verses 10 through 12, it says, "And showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It had a great and high wall and 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names were written on them, which are those of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel." You know, there's no doubt, again, to anyone, that God had a special plan for Israel under the Old Covenant times. But you know, it would appear, after a careful reading of the Scriptures and this whole compilation of Scriptures that will be available to you, from the passages just quoted, can it be denied that something has been overlooked in regards to this? That God has had and still has a special plan for His people Israel. And of course, these passages were not compiled to reveal their identity. But if it can be proven, as I think we have started to prove here this morning, if it can be proven that God has a plan for His people Israel, then it does become important to identify who those people Israel today are. Does it not? It certainly does. Well, the question then, who is Israel today? The Bible makes it very clear that we've got imposters today. Revelations 2:9 and 3:9 says that there are those who say they are Jews or Israelites, but are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. You know, they themselves, the Jews, they themselves to themselves, and those who are honest to others, make it very clear from what they say and what they've written that they are not Israelites at all. For example, in the 1980 Jewish Almanac, written by the Jews, chapter 1 is entitled "Identity Crisis, A Brief History of the Term for Jew." The first sentence reads this way, quote, "Strictly speaking, it is incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or a Hebrew." We find the same thing listed, and we won't take the time to do this, but in the Jewish Encyclopedia, volume 4, pages 1 through 5, explain the very same thing that's found there in the Jewish Almanac, that it is totally incorrect to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or an ancient Israelite a Jew. I want to read quickly from a book that I encourage you're getting, called "The Life of an American Jew in Racist Marxist Israel" by Jack Bernstein, who himself was an Ashkenazic Jew. He writes in this book, on page 5, "The powerful Zionist propaganda machine has led the American people to believe that a Jew is a Jew, one race of people, and that they are God's chosen people. I will deal with the chosen people lie later. First, it is important for you to understand that Jews are not one race of people. There are two distinct groups of Jews in the world, and they come from two different areas of the world. The Sephardic Jews from the Middle East and North Africa, and the Ashkenazi Jews come from Eastern Europe. The Sephardic is the oldest group, and it is they, if any, who are the Jews described in the Bible, because they lived in the area described in the Bible. They are blood relatives to the Arabs, and only difference between them is religion. The Ashkenazi Jews, who now comprise 90% of the Jews in the world, had a rather strange beginning. According to historians, many of them Jewish, the Ashkenazi Jews came into existence about 1,200 years ago." And then he goes on to explain how it came to be. I'm going to skip a little bit of what I was going to read there, but I want to read the challenge that Jack Bernstein puts out to his Jewish quote-unquote friends, and you'll see he doesn't recognize them as friends as I read this challenge, but I want to read the challenge that he puts out to his Jewish brethren. He says a challenge. The contents of this book are expected to bring a strong reaction from the Zionist Jews. I am well aware of the tactics of you, my Zionist brethren, used to quiet anyone who attempts to expose any of your subversive acts. If the person is a Gentile, you cry, "You're anti-Semitic," which is nothing more than a smokescreen to hide your actions. But if a Jew is the person doing the exposing, you resort to other tactics. First, you ignore the charges, hoping the information will not be given widespread distribution. If the information starts reaching too many people, you ridicule the information and the person or persons giving the information. If that doesn't work, your next step is character assassination. If the author or speaker hasn't been involved in sufficient scandal, you are adept at fabricating scandal against the person or persons. If none of these are effective, you are known to resort to physical attacks. But never do you try to prove the information wrong. So before you start your efforts to quiet me, I offer this challenge. You Zionists, assemble a number of Zionist Jews and witnesses to support your position, and I will assemble a like number of anti-Zionist pro-American Jews and witnesses. Then the Zionists and the anti-Zionists will state their position and debate their material in this book, as well as related material, the debate to be held on public television. Let's explore the information and let the American people decide for themselves if the information is true or false. Isn't that a fair challenge? Certainly you will willingly accept the challenge of what I have written if what I have written is false. But if you resort to crying lies, all lies, and refuse to debate the material, you will in effect be telling the American people that that what I have written are the true facts. Jack Bernstein, which was written in 1984, and I have as of yet know of no one, no Zionist Jew, that has taken up that challenge. And of course they will never take up that challenge, because they know if they do, their lies will be exposed. We could go on. Time permitting, I would have shared with you another quote from another Jew in Pastor Emery's An Open Letter to Any Minister Who Teaches the Jews or Israel. If you don't have this, by all means, you need to pick up one of these. And most of these things will be available through Scriptures for America. Well, you know what? If the Jews today, who so many people say are the true descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, if they themselves are declaring to us, or declaring to themselves, making it known that they are not Israel, then who is? You know, there's really only two groups that are in question, and the Jews have already disqualified themselves. But let's not let them do that so quickly. Let's look at some scriptural evidence for the identity of Israel today. Let's go to the Bible, and I really believe that that's the first place. I appreciate what Raymond Capp has done through archaeology to help prove that indeed the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian kindred that Israel was to become a great and mighty nation. But that in itself really doesn't prove anything, because there are several today great and mighty nations in the world today. But not only that, Israel was to become a multitude of nations. And again, remember that there are really only two in question. And even though the Jews have disqualified them, let's see which of the two groups really fulfills these scriptural qualifications as we look at them. Israel was to become a multitude of nations. And of course, with the two groups that are in question, only the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred people would fulfill that scriptural identification. Israel was to be a blessing to the rest of the nations in the world. What nation is it that has blessed the rest of the world? Well, it certainly hasn't been Judaism. Israel was to be the one nation given God's statutes and ordinances. And we need to ask the question, well, who prints today and worships from millions of copies of his statutes and ordinances? Israel was to carry the gospel to all the world. Again, we need to ask the question, who prints 98% of all the Bibles and who sends out 98% of all the missionaries? Israel's land was to be inhabited by a people gathered from many nations. Our very seal, E Pluribus Unum, declares that we are Israel, because E Pluribus Unum means out of many, one. And they were to be a land inhabited by people gathered from many nations into one. Israel's land was to be inhabited by a people who would live securely. You certainly can't look over to Palestine and see security. Israel was to have a land of unwalled villages without walls, bars, or gates. In light of this one, I want to share with you an event that took place a couple of years ago. I was Christmas time, and we were visiting my wife's parents. I sat down to watch a movie. How many of you have seen the movie The Frisco Kid? God forbid, but you can be honest if you have. The movie that was made, The Frisco Kid. Well, that movie is a movie that's about a Polish rabbi that is coming to America to go to San Francisco to become a rabbi for a Jewish community there. And it's played by Gene Wilder, who just so happens to be a Jew. What was interesting about this movie, in light of what I just said, that's quoted from Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 11, is that this Jewish rabbi, the story goes that this Jewish rabbi, he comes to New York and has to get across the United States to San Francisco, and thus becomes known as the Frisco Kid. And he joins up with this cowboy who volunteers to take him across. But what's interesting is in this movie is here is Gene Wilder, a Jew, playing a Jewish rabbi, coming to America, and as they're going across the prairies, they come to their first village or their first town. And guess what Gene Wilder says in this movie, The Frisco Kid? He says, "Wow, you don't have any walls or any gates or any bars around your city." You know, they sometimes let us know the truth that they know. We're just too ignorant sometimes to hear what they're telling us. Israel was known as God's sheep, and His sheep would hear His voice. And we need to ask, who is it? Who are the sheep today who are hearing His voice and following Him? Israel was the only people ever promised by God that He would answer their prayers and watch over them. And there's too many abundant scriptures to even list here. We need to ask the question, what people pray to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob down through the last score of centuries and have had their prayers answered and have been prospered by Him while other races sit in heathen darkness? Israel was to live on the islands and coasts of the earth. Israel was to colonize and spread abroad. Israel was to be devoured of her strength by strangers and not realize that it's happening. That's one that I don't think anybody's ever had in it before, but that is exactly what is happening to America today. And it's an identifying mark that we are Israel. And Israel would have an inner awareness of morality, another one that I don't think has been on those other lists. They have a basic understanding of what's right and wrong. They may be disobedient to that, but you can ask them, is it right? And they'll say no. If you ask another race of people and they don't know, or they have some other standard of morality. And Israel would be a people who would understand that Yahweh is their God and not Allah or some other God. It's found in Hebrews chapter 8, and again, these will be available to you. 2 minutes? You know, the scriptures very clearly, and I hope these will be useful to you. The scriptures very clearly identify who the Israelites are today. They are the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian kindred people. And what we find in the scriptures is backed up by the archaeological evidence that Raymond Capps has given us. It's backed up as well by evidence from our forefathers. An interesting quote, Thomas Jefferson on the death of George Washington said, "A great nation has fallen this day in Israel." Our forefathers understood that we were Israel. We may have lost that understanding at some point in time, and we're starting to regain it, but they understood who we were and who we are. It's also been identified, America has been identified by the United States Congress in 1859 as regathered Israel. Now, there's all kinds of evidence, if we'll just look, to see and for us to be able to see and understand who indeed the Israelites are today. Let me very quickly go over some of the reactions that we have to this doctrine. We have them screaming these at us all the time when someone like myself would get up and claim that no, indeed, it's not the Jews today who are Israel that God has a plan for, but instead it's us, the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian kindred people. First of all, they cry out, that's anti-Semitism. But you know, it's not anti-Semitism because the Jews today are not Semites, but instead either Edomites or Japhethites. And so it cannot be anti-Semitism. Next, they'll call, if that doesn't work, they'll then call out racism. But it's not racism, because if it's so, racism as they mean it, then God Himself was a racist. Because we're claiming today under the New Covenant nothing different from what God claimed and told us under the Old Covenant. And so if we're racist by their definition, then they have to say that God is a racist as well. And if that doesn't work, then they cry out white supremacy. But if you really understand what this is all about, it cannot be white supremacy because it doesn't elevate one race above the rest, but instead it makes one race a servant to the rest. It's not white racism. What it really is, what we teach, is white servanthood. And it's something that we need to make our people aware of. I want to read, even if I run out of time here on the video, I want to read from the Covenant People. And this is the book that I like to use above and beyond anything else, first of all, when sharing the identity truth. Not because it's superior in what it does, but because it deals with these objections or these criticisms to us so well. I want to read from three or four different paragraphs. Starting on page 2, it says, "The true effect of race knowledge." This is the book called The Covenant People, put out by Destiny Publishers, again available by Scriptures for America. And it says, "The true effect of race knowledge is not to feed our vanity or rouse our boastfulness. Rather, it should arouse a profound sense of responsibility." On page 3, it then goes on to say, today, which was 1966, it says, "Especially we feel a revulsion against speaking of race at all, and even more so today in today's society with people. We dislike drawing invidious distinctions between people, as some feel they must do if they open the subject of race. Many do not know how to discuss the fact except upon a formula of marking other races down, and we see in other countries to what hideous conditions such a course can lead. But all of this simply indicates some basic lack of knowledge in ourselves. I lay it down as a rule that whenever the thought of race leads us to boastfulness or contempt, there is something false in it." Two more paragraphs. On page 4 it says, "The Bible deals with one race which flows like a Gulf Stream through the ocean of humanity. As the actual Gulf Stream touches two continents and blesses the nations, so this race in its origin, history, and destiny was selected and equipped for the service of the nations." And then lastly on page 8, it says, "Of course many people still have their own ideas about this, and that creates a difficulty. For when people get their own ideas about things, it always leads to confusion. A man will rise up and demand, 'By what right does God choose one race of people above another?' I like that form of the question. It is much better than asking, 'By what right God degrades one people beneath another,' though that is implied. God's grading is always upward. If he raises up a nation, it is that other nations may be raised up through its ministry. If he exalts a great man, an apostle of liberty or science or faith, it is that he might raise a degraded people to a better condition. The divine selection is not a prize, a compliment paid to the man or the race. It is a burden imposed. To appoint a chosen people is not a pandering to the racial vanity of a superior people. It is a yoke bound upon the necks of those who are chosen for a special service." You know, we've just touched the surface of a study into the true identity of God's people. But you know, the choice is clear for us today. It's clear to the honest. It's clear to those who seek and search for truth. Yahshua said, "Seek and you shall find, ask and it shall be given to you, knock and the door shall be opened." It's clear to the brave, and I believe you have to be brave to take a look with honesty at this truth. And it's clear to the remnant. And I might say, I believe that we're not just the remnant people, we're the elite. And God has called us, and I mean elite not because of who we are, but because of Him who called us and has made us who we are. You know, and it's a truth that we need to understand and believe that we can stand on, that we can go from this mountain and stand on it with pride and know that we've got the evidence behind what we believe and go and share it with those brethren out in the religious world and our friends and family who so desperately need to understand this truth to be made more useful for their King. Thank you very much. Covenant relationship with their God.